Good afternoon. We're going to get started with our study of the apostolic writings. Let's begin with a prayer to start out with. Father, we thank you for giving us the testimony of all your witnesses down through time, and help us to understand the words of Messiah and help us to apply these to everyday life. We thank you for everything that you've provided. We thank you for him. In his name. Amen. We're going to be starting out with Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 42. Again, continuing on with our discussion that we've been building upon. And I hope what you've noticed here is, as we go through these so-called six antitheses, or these six tensions that in chapter 5 of Matthew that supposedly Yeshua was bringing, saying, you've heard it said, most often in the Torah, but I tell you, and saying something different, either negating it, canceling it, and sending it off in a different direction. So what we've looked at so far is that each one of these things that he's brought up brings a different view, but it's a different view, but really the different view was the original view. So you could say that it was different in that it was different from the interpretation of the given time. As we discussed at the outset of this, the "you have heard it said, but I tell you" is a very common phrase or kind of ties between thoughts that the sages would use when saying and amplifying what their interpretation was on things. So what you're seeing here is a taking it back to the original interpretation that it had from the beginning. And what we'll be looking at today is described, you'll see it in Hebrew, as ayin tachat ayin, or ayin ba'ayin, or an eye in place of an eye, or an eye with an eye. It'd be two ways it had said. The passage we'll start out with first is in Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 through 42. "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to see you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with them too. And do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you." If you have something that they can borrow. Now, looking first at this phrase, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And when you look at this, this has been a favorite target of skeptics of God and skeptics of the Bible down through time. In modern days, this is one of the problematic, you'll hear people say. Even a number of believers, both Jewish and Christian, have a lot of problems with this. These are people who have a strong belief in God because they look at this and go, "You got to be kidding. This doesn't sound like a nice God. Why would God say something like this?" And it's seen as, thus, this is one of those supposed antitheses or teachings that are in contrast to each other that people would like to say is valid, because they would like to dismiss ayin tachat ayin, because that would be nice. But what we're going to take a look at is what this actually says. This is often referred to as lex talionis, which is, of course, the Latin version for that, lex meaning law, and talionis meaning retaliation. We have retaliation, comes from talion in Latin, and retribution is often another way it's described. The retaliation is often defined as attack or an assault in return for a similar attack, coming from re, which is Latin for back or going back, and talionis, which means in kind or the same or as such. So this is giving back what was given. Retribution comes from, you might recognize the word tribute. Tribute meaning something that's assigned. Originally, tribute comes from tribe, which is a Latin word, which of course means tribe. And tribute was meant that you divide things that were supposed to be between tribes into their portions. So thus, it came to mean assign. So basically, the idea of retribution means is that you're assigning something back in proper form to what should be deserved. So we say they get what they deserve. That's a good definition for retribution in its literal sense like that. So one of the things to take a look at is what the Torah says and doesn't say about lex talionis. The first place we're going to be looking at this is the first two passages that use the phrase ayin tachat ayin. And the one from Deuteronomy uses ayin b'ayin. Starting out first will be our first passage there in Exodus 21, verses 22 through 27. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child, so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand it of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But there, if there is any other further injury, then you shall appoint it as a penalty, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go on account of his tooth. So this, you know, comes from this passage, a greater passage in 21 and 22 specifically, but those passages. So it's going to be kind of interesting. Because as we'll see here, this passage is sandwiched right in between 20, which is, you know, is where the Ten Commandments are, and 23, which is a bit of a reiteration of the Ten Commandments in a different form. And 21 and 22 sandwiched in between here with a lot of these mishpatim or judgments that come in there. And it's not coincidental why they're there. As you could say, judgments being applications to specific circumstances of the Torah as they go along. Now, one of the things that you see there in this passage is what jumps out at you in this passage here in Exodus 21. What is this referring to? You might see it there at the end of verse 22. It says here, and as the judges determine. So this is not, you know, you go out and you feel slighted and go knock someone else's tooth out or poke their eye out. Okay, so this is talking about in a judicial situation, which means that you are not taking vengeance yourself. If something happens, you get injured, someone injures you, you feel slighted, it goes to the judicial court. That's the underlying principle of this. You know, a lot of skeptics like to lay claim of the details in this. A lot of these things don't apply anymore because we don't have that type of economic system at the moment. You know, hopefully we don't get back to that anytime soon. But it's not in place at the moment. But the underlying principle is if there is a slight or if there is an injury, it goes to the court system. It's something that we take forward today. That principle there. The second passage that we'll take a look at is in Leviticus 24, in verses 17 through 22. Now, in this is kind of an interesting situation where this one shows up, is that this is a mishpatim, a judgment. But it says that this is something, a command. Literally, it's from the mouth of God. It comes out of God's mouth, and this is in the context of this situation where you have a son of an Israelite woman and an Egyptian man, and he gets into a fight, and in the midst of it, it says that he blasphemed the name and cursed. So this is kind of the greater context there in Leviticus 24. So starting in verse 17, "If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. The one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good life for life. If a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted upon him. Thus, the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as the native, for I am the Lord your God." Now, one of the things you can see in this context, remember, the context of this was related to a situation where someone in the midst of a fight, blasphemed the name of the Lord, and it says, cursed. So these things that we see there comes stemming from what we talked about the last time around, from the Ten Commandments, talking about taking the Lord's name in vain. And what we talked about there is that the Hebrew word shu, which is translated vain, you see throughout the book of Ecclesiastes in the sense of making it of no effect, making it meaningless, destroying it, or, as we were talking about last time around, using it, carrying the name, using the name in a way that's deceitful, meaning that you are trying to ply someone with it. So it's interesting, because that's what the context of where this little passage in Leviticus 24 comes from. So then it goes into talking about if someone murders someone else, then life for life. If you kill someone's animal, then you have to replace the animal or its value. That's where the context of this is. So that's quite of interest. Why is it just, is this like a non sequitur? Just, in the midst of talking about this guy with the blasphemy, and just happens to mention now, capital punishment. And what is the connection between blaspheming and capital punishment? What we had talked about before was taking the name, making it meaningless. So if you're taking the name of, as Richard was talking about, someone acting that you don't see acting, you are in a sense killing God. Because blasphemy means you're taking the name and putting it down, destroying it. So you're literally killing God and those who hear it. It's the same, why do you think the Proverbs associate slander with murder? Because that idea is, you see it translated on into the lists of people. You'll see in the apostolic letters that they'll say, among the people who are condemned, it mentions a whole bunch of people, and slanderers are in there too. And you're like, well, boy, that's a pretty harsh offense. The one of the things you see here is that blaspheming is in a sense of killing God in the minds of those who hear it. Now, you might say, well, they're big people, they can deal with it. Well, what about the kids? What about the people who maybe have doubts and this or that or the other? And here you are destroying the source of all life, the source of all help, everything in the minds of them. That's an extremely serious thing. So thus, it is as if you are taking the life of God. Now, it's quite interesting, as we'll get down a little bit further, as to how God deals with that. The next passage that we'll take a look at is in Deuteronomy 19, verses 15 through 22. Deuteronomy 19 and 15. This is a very interesting passage where this shows up. In Deuteronomy 19, this is a very strong punishment related to perjury. We had just looked at the beginning of Deuteronomy in our Torah study today about how, you know, you have to have very accurate, don't play into false testimony and this kind of thing. Well, this drills in even further on false testimony. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men shall have the dispute, shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who will be in office in those days. The judges shall investigate thoroughly, and if the witness is a false witness, and he has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he had intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. The rest will hear and be afraid, and will never again do such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall not show pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. So, again, you have this passage that's building upon, you know, first off, one of the Ten Commandments in that, you know, in Exodus 20:16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now that, people say, well, lying in general, but that is the basic meaning of that, the basic meaning. And when you have a court system, the basic fundamental thing you have to have is the veracity, the dependability of witnesses. Because without witnesses and the ability to trust witnesses, what court system do you really have? It's just one person's opinion versus someone else. You have no evidence. No evidence. Because a witness may be physical, and it's also the testimony of witnesses too. So you have this. This is discussed in this chapter. Chapter 19 also talks about the importance of witnesses, but this idea of two or three witnesses, you have to be able to depend upon those witnesses. It's extremely important. We always talk about, well, on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Can you believe those witnesses? Are those witnesses lying? That's what this is getting at. Are they lying? Do they have an agenda? And when you look at this bearing false witness, well, that comes from the Ten Commandments, that's among these things relating to the proper treatments of one's parents, spouse, their staff or servants, livestock, and their, quote, neighbor. We'll be getting more to that in a minute, because that gets back to Yeshua's whole point in Matthew chapter 5. Now, in the context, we talk about neighbor, the context of the second commandment, the second greatest commandment, which comes from Leviticus 19:18, you love your neighbor as yourself. The context of that is very similar to Deuteronomy 19, and for a very similar reason. Let's start in Leviticus 19, starting with verse 15. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So when you wonder what the base meaning of this in Leviticus 19 is, this is it, of the idea of love your neighbor. What does it mean to love your neighbor? It means you don't take vengeance. You don't bear a grudge. Vengeance, That can be a quick or it could be a long-term thing. A grudge is definitely something that you carry for a long time. And grudges eat at you. And they just eat and eat and eat away at you for a long, long time.
Wouldn't the lack of enforcement of laws increase the amount of grudges and vengeance? Because when we go to law, we expect fairness. And when we see the law has no effect and either the courts are corrupt, the people are corrupt, or they don't exist, then is when we get into grudge and vengeance because there's no recourse.
Yeah, especially when you take a look at the context of these passages, especially, what is it? Yes, here in Leviticus 19, as it's talking about being partial to the poor. Being partial to the poor. Now that is quite an interesting thing when you talk about the sanctity and the purity of your judicial system. That means you do not take into consideration the person's background. It's either the crime or it's not the crime. It's not their situation or this or that or the other. Mercy is completely different from justice. That's one of the big things that comes down in here. And as we'll get to it in a moment, it's mercy follows justice. Mercy doesn't precede justice. You don't suspend justice or a judgment because of mercy. Now, mercy can set aside punishment of it, but it doesn't supersede the justice to begin with. Now, that's extremely important as we get to what Ellie was talking about when people do not see that something is being taken care of and they just decide to take things into their own hands and have their own vengeance. One of the interesting aspects of this, when we talk about this rolling forward, is the end of Deuteronomy in chapter 32, verse 35. This is amidst this long discussion for several chapters talking about warning Israel that if you turn away from God after he's done all this and taken them so far, that you're going to go off into captivity. You know, you're going to have people that will spread you off into the winds and will dominate over you. And that will be the Lord's doing. But he emphasizes here in 32:35, vengeance is mine and retribution. He is going to be one. And this was so important that it got repeated and quoted several times by various different writers throughout, by different apostles, Romans 12, Hebrews 10, and you could see allusions to it in some of the writings of Peter as well. That this idea that it is not delayed or postponed or something, God is going to take care of this. And when you see the writings of the prophets, and you see like in passages like the Messiah brought forward in Matthew 24, an example of that, and then you see also in the writings of both Paul and Peter, that, and Yohanan, John, in Revelation, that this is something that is coming. It is something that is coming. Now, as it's described in the prophets, it's a strange act. It's a foreign act for God to act this way. But it is something that he has to do. And as you see at the end of the book of Revelation, you see why it has to be done that way. So it's not something that will never happen, but you have to have faith that God is going to actually take care of this. No matter how monstrous the crime actually is, or how big the slight against you yourself is, you have to trust that God is going to be the one to take care of it. And vengeance and a grudge can take different measures. People always talk about this, quote, passive-aggressive form of vengeance. Now, that is also a form of vengeance. You're trying to get back at someone without supposedly getting back at them, but you are. So it is, and it definitely eats at you over time. Now, one of the injunctions that we see about testifying falsely, you see in Exodus 23. So Exodus 20, Ten Commandments, Exodus 21, 22, all these judgments of applying these things variously. Now we get down to Exodus 23, and you're back to perjury again. Wow, that's quite an interesting place for this to show up. And then it starts out with perjury and then goes down into a whole bunch of other different things. And notice in here what is said about your own enemies and strangers or outsiders. Because now you'll start seeing why it is that Messiah said, "But I tell you." So let's start off here in Exodus 23, starting with verse 1 and going down through verse 12. "You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute." Now, just stopping there for a moment, this expands upon what we've seen so far about testifying. Now, this is about mob rule. Vengeance often involves a mob. Doesn't always. There are a lot of people who decide to go off on their own and do stuff. But one of the things that people have noticed over time regarding mobs is that people get emboldened in them. They think they're not going to be... anyone's going to figure out who specifically did anything, so they can just do whatever they want. Continuing on with verse 4. "If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey or one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall not refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him." Now, just stopping there for a moment. What does that sound like? Parable of the Good Samaritan? Yeah, kind of sound like that. Continuing on, verse 6. "You shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent or the righteous. For I will not acquit the guilty." Okay, just stopping there again. Now, we sent all the thing about capital punishment, and we just saw the passage before about investigating things thoroughly. Well, who do you think the judgment is going to come down upon if you execute the innocent? Yeah, the judge. That's who it's going to come down on. Starting in verse 8. "You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe binds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger. For you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall sow your land for 6 years and gather its yield. But on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat. And whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. But you are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave, as well as your stranger, may refresh themselves." Now notice that in this, that's the enemy is part of this injunction, this command here going forward about the importance of justice. This whole thing is talking about justice here, and that the enemy is included in justice. So person you have something against, or they have something against you, you still have to act in a way that is just, a way that is right. The way the situation has. As it mentions in here, if you see him struggling, or if you see something that he's lost or something, you have to return it to him. If you see he's having problems, you have to help him. That's included in justice. Now notice also in here that this is really getting at, as you see with the parable of the Good Samaritan, that the parable of the Good Samaritan was in the context of discussion of Leviticus 19:18. This love your neighbor. And he's asking, well, who's my neighbor? And then Yeshua starts off with the parable of the Good Samaritan, answering, indeed, what is meant by neighbor. Now, if you might recall, the Samaritans were considered enemies by quite a number of Jews. You know, we've talked about that in times past. They did all kinds of nefarious things. You know, some would say them more tricksters, but they did things like subverting the declaration of when the new moons would happen and such like that. That was some of the least of things that happened. You know, there's even claims that they helped the Romans in some regard during their occupation. So definitely not liked, yet considered in this group of what's included as neighbor. Now you notice also in this that at the end of this you've got like the sabbatical year and the Shabbat, the Sabbath, included in this as well. Huh. Now that's interesting. Because you notice in there what is being focused on about the sabbatical year and the Shabbat. It's not you. It's the other people. For the sabbatical year, it's the poor, the hungry, who need to eat what grows of itself. And in the Shabbat, what's being focused on there is that, if you recall from the Ten Commandments, it says that this Shabbat also applies to everybody inside your gates, including livestock and servants, but within your gates and includes things under your control as well. So you think about in today's society, the things that you have control over and what or whom is included in that. So you see in that regard of neighbor or stranger, that is a context and a understanding of the law of justice that has to be taken in and seen as a favorable approach that you take to your who you think of as an enemy and who may think of themselves as an enemy against you. Now you notice also that the Torah does include some instructions. We talked about this as we ended Numbers about what to do with someone who is considered to be guilty or suspected of being guilty of negligent manslaughter. And that is in Numbers 35 as it talks about the cities of refuge. So there you have another example of justice preceding mercy. Justice being accusation is there. There is a redeemer of blood. That is not just someone acting on their own. They are actually an agent of the court in that sense. And really to, in a sense, if you think about it, they're to herd the people, herd the guilty into a city of refuge. Because, you know, if you have somebody who's coming after you, wouldn't you want to go to some place where they couldn't get you? And that was specifically a place where, by law, the Redeemer of Blood could not get you. Now, you know, one of the things we should also keep in mind here is with this, as we talk about judgments, is that these systems of justice have to have the components in place. And with the cities of refuge and the Redeemer of Blood, you have to start thinking of vengeance. Okay, well now there's no cities of refuge, so now I can just chase them wherever I want to. Well, no. Because a part of that system is the city of refuge. Without the city of refuge, there is no mercy. It is justice without mercy. Because remember, we were talking about that, and Richard was saying, look, you know, in that sense, not even the Day of Atonement is going to save you. That's extremely heavy. So that person would be without mercy. So as we look at this, is this what the Torah is teaching of lex talionis, you know, You get it tit for tat. You just dish out whatever someone gives you. You know, we've seen quite a few cases of this so far where that's not indeed the case. Now, we've seen some precedents for what we see, you know, the ayin tachat ayin beginning in Genesis all the way back into the beginning, really in chapter 4, with the vengeance. The word for vengeance you often see throughout the Tanakh is nakam. And nakam is an idea of, it can be seen as vengeance, but in the various places where you do see it, it's really quite an interesting thing, is that it involves also a form of justice. But you consider at that time, it doesn't say whether we had courts in place or not, so how that is carried out, not really known. But you have some form of justice in that regard with one of the things that God says there in Genesis chapter 4 with Cain. And you might recall as we went through the idea with Cain is that God said, okay, now you've got to be banished out of here. And Cain says back to him, well, this punishment is more than I can bear. Whoever's going to find me is going to kill me. And then God says, well, whoever kills Cain, the sevenfold judgment comes upon him. So with that, it's kind of interesting. You got even a multiplier effect when you're talking with Cain, in that you don't want to mess with Cain to kill him, because the sevenfold judgment comes down upon your head. You see it also again within Genesis chapter 9 after the flood. After the flood, in the first seven verses of chapter 9, talking about the effects of that in man getting the permission to eat animals, you know, most likely because there wasn't much growing at that time. But also, mankind could not eat blood. And it mentions in there specifically because the life is in the blood. That becomes very important down as you start seeing when God puts the tabernacle in place and that special meaning of blood and life and connection between those. And then you see that amplified extremely in the time of Messiah and what Messiah means and what he did means about life being in the blood. And then it also comes down to the idea of blood for blood punishment. If someone kills a man, he must be killed. That's all wrapped up together, and especially it gives it in the context of Genesis 1, you know, the end of it, where it mentions that God made man in the image of God. And that is why. So now you start seeing as it comes around to talk about blaspheming the name of God, and also in this term of killing a person, and then life being demanded of the person who kills a person. So as you come down to that, we get down into, well, where do we go from here? And we get down into a great passage of in Colossians. You might recall that passage in Colossians, where it's talking about that the certificate of ordinances that was against us, he has taken away and nailed it to his cross. Ordinances in Greek is the same word as mishpatim, judgments in the Septuagint. The Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures uses the same word that you see there in Colossians. So we're talking about what was the certificate or the handwriting of ordinances that was against us? Well, I think we've rattled off quite a few of them already here of various ways that you can incur the death penalty, various ways that that could happen. And when you start thinking about the idea of blasphemy, about making God's name of no effect, that's a pretty serious thing, and it can be done in ways small and ways great, making God's name of no effect. Because you remember, back in the garden, with Adam and Eve. One of the main things there was the big question, did God really say? Did God really say? And what was that all about? Trust, often described as faith, faith in God and believing Him. What was the big thing that Abraham was described as doing, that it was credited to him as righteousness? Believing what God had said to him about something that would happen that seemed incredible that would happen to him, about becoming a great and mighty, numerous nation when he had no children. And then also at the time period when he's then asked to take the son that seems to be the answer to that and now sacrifice him. Wow. That idea of trust, trust in God, and not trusting in God and what he says. Now you can start seeing why blasphemy is not just a simple thing, and why taking God's name in vain is not just saying what you might say is bad words. It's something hugely, hugely different. Because, you know, like in today's society, with we're connected with lights and amplification and cars and everything else like that, you shut off electricity, and we don't go anywhere. We hardly do anything. A lot of businesses can't do a thing anymore. We're helpless. You know, they even talk about what would happen if there was a massive disruption via an EMP bomb or something over the United States, that, you know, we would lose a third of our population within 6 weeks because, no, you can't get the food, you can't get this and that. Well, think about that in the sense of what you do if you cut yourself off from the Creator and the Sustainer of all things. In a sense, it's going to be lights out in pretty quick order. And you see kind of the culmination of what happens when people systematically disconnect themselves from the Creator and Sustainer of all things, and even the Redeemer, when they cut themselves off from God's mercy. We see what we see in the prophets and in Revelation. But justice, mercy. God offers mercy and offsets that. Can take those certificates of death that were against us and nail them to the stake upon which our Savior willingly gave himself up on. Now you see there, ultimate justice, ultimate mercy. That's what I hope you see is a picture of what Messiah is getting at. So then when you take that forward and say, you know, someone is going to demand something from you, it's an ultimate mercy to then go forward with that. It's not an easy thing. But then when you start thinking of what is talked about in the Psalms, that, you know, he owns the cattle on a thousand hills, basically, what do we say every time as we end our services? The one who brings forth bread from the earth, the Creator of the fruit of the vine. Everything we have comes from him. So we have to be prepared to actually lose it, which I know for myself, being definitely an addict of stuff, it is a tough thing to then give it up. An extremely, extremely tough thing. But it's connected to this idea of loving your neighbor as yourself. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for giving us the testimony of all your witnesses down through time. And Father, help us to love our neighbors, love the people around us, love even the people who hate us and the people that we hate as we love ourselves. Father, we thank you for the mercy you show us in the face of all the justice that we deserve. We thank you for this in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.